Nick DiDomenico. I'd just like to add to that. Timing's very important to this project, given the 30% ITC. It's our intent, should it be permitted, to basically start this project in August. There's currently a moratorium on a TIF. The legislature doesn't sit. I mean, for all practical, it's impossible to get a TIF for this project. I think that, end of discussion.
excuse me, could I sort of get back to the Bicknell's Thrush and the rare, excuse me, the subalpine fir that Mr. Hudson had talked about. The notion of the habitat regenerating. Now I'm thinking of whether it's a an impact from ice throw or a moose that overwinters in a area of the vegetation, or if it's cutting. That happens fairly dramatically in terms of a short amount of time, but the revegetation takes quite a bit longer. How is that going to affect the bird habitat? Do you know what I'm saying? You don't grow trees and cut them as quickly. It's not happening at the same pace. And I'm just wondering if that has been taken into consideration. And then also, Mr. Hudson, wondering if you can help me with the inconsistency. People describe this particular congregation of trees as fragile, rare, fragile, and yet you've described them as very sturdy and capable of accommodating a number of impacts. And that inconsistency is a little bothersome, particularly in light of the assurances that we've been given that, you know, something will revegetate and there'll be habitat and things have happened in the past and they will continue into the future. So maybe a team approach to that.
Peter Vickery, I mean, I would say that, and I'll make an error and Don will correct me, but that these areas are dynamic habitats. I think that's what Don was trying to suggest, that they're not static in time, and that they will be exactly the same. They are obviously habitats that face very harsh winter conditions. So whether it's ice storms, et cetera. So there are changes on the landscape. And there's no doubt that, you know, if a Bicknell's thrush had a nest 3 years ago right in the spot where the moose decided to bed down for the winter, the bird is not going to be able to put a nest in that spot again. And so it will presumably look for something in the surrounding area. That's just part of the changes that take place. Over some period of time, that area will regenerate, and presumably another thrush, another female, would be putting a nest in there 10, 20, 30 years down the road. Does that help you?
If Mr. Hudson could follow up on that.
Don Hudson.
Could I just suggest that everybody speak up? I don't know whether we can adjust the. Okay.
Obviously, the clearing of a forest to build a road is a different event than a wind throw or a moose eating all the trees, and yet, in the grand scheme of things, the forest has survived similar events to road building over the thousands of years that it's been in these mountains. And when the ice retreated, the forest was at a lower elevation than it is now. And you've heard testimony, or you've read testimony, that as the climate changes, the more temperate forests may move higher on the mountains and slowly but surely shrink the area available to fir the fir birch forest that we see there on these mountains. And just as with the birds being able to move on the landscape, I think actually it's probably easier for the plants. This plant community is one that is actually fairly widespread around the entire northern hemisphere and has been so for millions of years. And it's quite capable of dealing with small patches of ground. And it has been fragmented by climate or by topography or by geological events or any number of different factors during its existence. So when I look at the insult to that forest that this road might present, for example, it doesn't strike me as something that is immediately, drastically threatening to the existence of that forest. Far more important to me, as you know from my testimony, is the fact that we humans are changing the global climate in a way that impacts in ways that are dramatic. I think I mentioned in my testimony the fact that, or if I didn't, I'll mention to you right now, that in the past, in Umanak, Greenland, 3 years in the past 10, people couldn't go out in the ice because it wasn't thick enough. And they couldn't conduct the way of life that they've lived for thousands of years as a result of that change. And so that greatly influences how much I'm willing to tolerate as someone who has a great affection for the mountains. Believe me, I've walked on most of the hills and mountains in this state and in New Brunswick and in Quebec and in Newfoundland and in Labrador where this forest type exists. I go there whenever I get a chance. I absolutely love it. And yet, I think that the impacts here are well-defined and limited and do not threaten the forest on that ridge overall. It will persist and persist nicely for the full life of this project and beyond.
As a follow-up to that, at what point, what is the tipping point there? At what point do we know that it is starting to have an impact that would be negative?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question, because I have been to places where very small patches of subalpine forest exist. And so I would imagine that you could get down to a handful of acres and still find subalpine forest. And is that an argument that we can therefore go ahead and alter conditions on a mountaintop and eliminate all 95% because we know or at least we're going to have 5%? For me, I don't have an absolute number. Here we're talking about an impact to a small percentage on that mountain of perhaps a little more than 10% on that mountain, if I have the numbers correct in my head. And that's an acceptable limit to me. You know that I'm not asked to testify on lots of these projects, and I do so here because I have a particular experience with the high mountain region. And that's acceptable to me, knowing that there is an additional several thousand acres in the immediate surrounding area that has just simply not been mapped yet. It's right. Probably close to 3,000 acres in the immediate area that won't have wind power development, and thus the forest has a toehold there.
But how do we know TransCanada or somebody else isn't going to come back and want to develop? This is something I'm struggling a little bit with, and that is sort of, at what point do we know that we've eroded something beyond, say, what the co-op directs us, our goals? How do we know when we're there? And that has to do with, the primitive character of the area. That has to do with the wildlife habitat. That has to do with people's perception of the kind of recreation. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of a recreational spectrum that we were told about, and how, whether in the science that we have today, whether we have a way of looking at that and so that we have a little better idea of when do we actually reach a point where we've got to say, no more. And anyway, I'm going to probably throw that out a couple of times today, and I wanted to make sure that you folks had a chance to respond to that.
I think Christine wants to say something.
Sure.
Christine Cinnamon with TransCanada. I'd just like to respond to that. The purpose of doing our studies, working closely with the agencies that are the regulators of habitat, they are the ones that guide us in mapping these areas and in understanding what would be an undue adverse impact versus not. And so that's why that relationship is so important to us. It's important to us to have experts that guide us in that as well. And it's up to you, the commission, to make decisions on what is acceptable and what isn't. And that, of course, is based on the evidence that you hear from your experts, the agencies that we've worked with. Taking that or answering you from a high-level perspective, there very rarely do we see a threshold number thrown out as to what is acceptable versus what is not. That is why we have the commitment to avoid and minimize to the greatest extent possible. That's why we take that as our first cut and to present that to IFNW, to MNAP, to make sure they're comfortable with the results that we're showing. Every one of these projects is taken on a case-by-case basis, and that's why we present evidence specific to that case-by-case basis, and you have the ability to make the decision on a specific project. If new evidence is presented down the road on a new project that suggests that that there are differences, be it related to climate change, be it related to something else that hasn't previously been shown, that will be taken into account, I'm certain, in your decision.
Go ahead.
When I first came to these mountains with an eye for wind development, it was in 1993, and I was struck by the very dramatic industrial nature of the region. Although remote, these mountains have been quite aggressively managed for fiber for a long time, and so that was important to me, and therefore I think that, and that's different than a lot of mountain areas in Maine and the region.
So let me take this a little further. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we should further industrialize the area?
No. But I do think that with the review by state natural resource agencies and by the commission of proposed projects, it's through your deliberations that the balance is struck. And I don't have the map of the original Kennetec proposal in my head, but it was quite dramatic and included a number of other mountains and ridges that have been excluded through the back and forth with agencies and with commission over time. And I think that that's, for me, that's how the balance gets struck. And I come in my written testimony and today simply to say that the impact to those acres on CISC aren't going to shift that balance dramatically. Okay. This forest is very resilient, and if there aren't wind towers on those ridges in 25 years, if at the end of the life of the project we've shifted to some other means of generating power, then eventually those roads will disappear to subalpine forest again, so long as the climate doesn't change dramatically, and then, you know, then they may shift to something else that we more typically see on lower elevations. But that's the way I look at it, and I'm not in a position to determine how much wind development you can make in this area.
That's our job, I guess, huh? The tough job. Jeff, one last question. Can you just I sort of missed the point of your, and it's was a little bit distracted here. Of the, you were going through a list of places in Maine where of state or national, regional significance where wind power could not be easily be allowed within the expedited area. And what was the point of that?
Sure. What I was trying to do was I was not trying to suggest that wind power would not be allowed there. There has been a suggestion made by the consolidated parties that the Kibbeh Expansion Project area has particularly high natural resource values or high public values that would weigh against wind power development, and that there are many other areas in the expedited area that don't have these public resource values. And so what I was trying to demonstrate is that if you look at areas where wind exists, where a high wind resource exists, it typically exists in an area that also has some significant public value. So I was not meaning to imply that wind would not be permitted there. It's just that these are areas, these are the things that the commission would have to wrestle with in those areas, and that the Kibbeh expansion area in particular had fewer significant public resource values with which you should wrestle.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. Okay, go ahead, Steve.
This is really just, I think, for our information or my information. I live on the Canadian border in the Washington County area, and quite often the New Brunswick has a lot to say about what might go on the border. Is there any, and this is certainly not part of our application process or anything, but being this tight to the Canadian border, is there any discussions with Canada? And you guys must have the inside edge talking to Canada, but I mean, is that going to be an issue going forward? It's obviously not now.
We've looked across the border at what might be present there. There is nothing that would raise any issues. And we are very familiar with permitting wind in Quebec. So we do have experts that we engaged to make sure that was the case. We're not aware of any issues.
We're behind, folks, but we're having a lot of good discussion here. And do commissioners, I think we're going to learn more as we go through the day. Do commissioners have any other questions they'd like to ask at this point? The way our schedule reads here, there's an opportunity now for staff, if the staff has any questions they'd like to ask. And then also any governmental agencies. And I know there's some of you folks out there. I guess seeing none, we now move into the cross-examination by the consolidated parties. And go right ahead.
Does this one work? This one works.
Hello? I guess that works. All right. Starting off, Dave Publicover with the Appalachian Mountain Club. My first question is for Mr. DiDomenico. All right. Nick, on page 6 of your pre-file, you noted 3 reasons why this site is particularly well-suited for wind power development, and that included the outstanding wind resource, proximity to existing infrastructure, and its location within the expedited permitting zone. And on page 10, you state, the Kibbeh expansion, and I'm quoting, from your testimony. The Kibbe Expansion Project is located in the area specifically designated by the task force and the legislature as appropriate for wind power development. Now, I question that statement, and I'm going to read you a paragraph from the wind siting law. It's 35A, section 3402.2. And that paragraph states, the legislature further finds that while wind energy may be developed at many sites with minimal site-specific environmental impacts, wind energy development may have, in addition to their beneficial environmental effects and potential scenic impacts, specific adverse environmental effects that must be addressed in state permitting decisions pursuant to approval criteria tailored to address issues presented by wind energy development. Nothing in this section is meant to diminish the importance of addressing as appropriate site-specific impacts on natural values, including but not limited to wildlife, wildlife habitats, and other ecological values. Now, in light of this language, would you agree that the inclusion of a site within the expedited area does not create a determination that that site is appropriate for development?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, and that it's entirely reasonable that a site within the expedited area could be deemed to be inappropriate for development because of site-specific issues.
I would agree with that also.
All right, thank you. I'd like to move on, and Dylan, I'd like to move on to Ms. Cinnamon, and I'm going to be showing you a few pages, and Dylan is going to give those to the commission. As well as to Chris. The first page is from the application for the original Kibbe project. It's page 7-1, the first page of the natural resources section. Do you have that? Dylan has given that, you've given that to her. Could you read these?
No.
All right, could you read the sentence that's highlighted in yellow, please?
Certainly. Note that as sensitive natural features have been identified through the course of project field efforts, the project design has been adjusted to avoid impacts to such areas to the greatest extent possible.
Okay, and I'd like to specifically point out language, avoid impacts to such areas to the greatest extent possible. Now, regarding impacts to the fir, heartleaf, birch, subalpine community, in the original Kibbe project, your goal was to stay out of that community, and you were successful in that. The impacts to that community were negligible or minimal. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Dylan, if you could give her the next page. All right. This is page B15-1 of the current application. And if you could read the sentence that's highlighted in yellow, please.
Note that as sensitive natural features have been identified through the course of project field efforts, the project design has been adjusted to avoid and minimize impacts to such areas to the extent possible, given engineering and land constraints.
Okay. You'd agree that the language of this sentence is different than the language of the equivalent sentence in the original Kibbe application?
I would agree that it is different. What I would like to add to that, or to clarify, is that we didn't want to just cut and paste from the Kibbe application. So despite the fact that the approach was identical, we thought it might be good to add some clarification for the commission's benefit so that they understood what other things had to be considered in minimizing and avoiding to the greatest extent possible. And so as per my testimony, the approach is identical to that on Kibbe. This sentence does not indicate anything different, and that is the exact approach that we used on Kibbe, despite the clarification that was added in this application.
All right. And I would move on. Dylan, can you give me the third page? This is page B66 of the current application. And it's from the section on road access and design. And if you could read the sentence at the top that's highlighted in yellow.
Routing of the Crane roads has taken into consideration the same physical and environmental considerations as the new access road, with special emphasis placed on totally avoiding any disturbance within the Bicknell's thrush core habitat and bog lemming habitat, and minimizing to the maximum extent practical impact within the overall Bicknell's thrush and subalpine fir habitats.
All right. So just looking at the plain language that's in the application, in the original Kibbe application, the standard was to avoid impacts to the greatest extent possible. In this application, you use the language minimizing to the maximum extent practicable. Would you agree that avoid to the greatest extent possible has a different meaning than minimizing to the maximum extent practicable?
I would agree with that.
All right. And as a standard of environmental protection, just considering the plain meaning of the language, that minimizing to the greatest extent practicable would be considered a weaker standard than avoiding to the greatest extent possible.
I would agree if that was the only consideration. I think we're getting a little bit hung up on words here. And with respect to our commitment and the approach that we took in citing project elements, we did it the exact same way. I was involved in that, so I can tell you that there was no difference in how we approached that. The outcome may be slightly different in what we were able to completely avoid on Kibbe and what we were able to completely avoid on the Kibbe expansion project.
Well, even though you say the intent was the same, again, I think words have meanings and will allow the commission to draw their own conclusions. But again, given the impacts to this community on Kibbe project, you stayed out of it. Isn't it true that if you had applied that same standard to this project, that there wouldn't be a project? There wouldn't be an expansion project?
I'd have to pass that over to my colleagues.
I mean, I think Christine, sorry, Terry Bennett, TransCanada, I think Christine has answered the question. We don't change our standards from project to project, whether it's wind projects or any other projects. Every single project that TransCanada undertakes is taken to the same standards.
All right, and I have one more question. You state that in the project design that impacts have been minimized to the greatest extent practicable. Isn't it true that that's not the standard by which LERC should judge the project, but in fact they actually have to judge it on the actual impacts that remain?
I would absolutely agree with that.
And that even though the impacts have been minimized to the greatest extent practicable, the remaining impacts could still be considered unacceptable.
That's absolutely right. Minimizing and avoiding does not mean zero. It didn't mean zero on Kibbe, and it doesn't mean zero here. And that's why we seek the advice of the agencies in understanding those impacts and presenting them. So finally, LERC can make the decision on what may be undue versus not.
All right. Thank you. And I'm going to pass it over now to Jen Gray.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jen Gray with Maine Audubon of the Consolidated Parties, and I have some questions for Dana Ballou. Hi. Are you familiar with the Evers Breeding Bird Report TransCanada submitted last Thursday evening?
Yes, I am.
I'd like you to direct you to the report, pages 32 to 37. These pages address the spot mapping that was done. Do you have the report in front of you?
I don't. I can speak to the spot mapping without
so
seeing the report.
Those pages show the figures of the spot mapping.
Sure.
That was conducted. Each point on the figure, I believe, represents a bird observation.
Observations of birds, right.
So points.
Sorry, what page was that?
Pages 32 to 37.
Mm-hmm.
These points may represent one bird moving around and observed at different locations, or it may be multiple birds. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Evers also makes a determination in the report that the Bicknell thrush density in the project area is 0.33 thrush per hectare. Is that correct? And I can refer you to page 15 of the report, the first full paragraph. Page 15 of the report, the first full paragraph. It's about the seventh line down. Much lower than our its estimated density of 0.33 thrush.
Yes, yep, that's correct.
Doesn't Evers also say further down on the page that this estimate is conservative and that density could actually be much higher? It actually says estimates are conservative with densities right. most likely lower than what they may actually be.
Right, and that's due to the complex breeding system.
Right, right. But they could
correct.
Be higher.
Correct.
They're likely higher.
Correct.
The applications... identifies an area of core habitat, and this area that you've identified is consistent with the results you found from the spot mapping. Is that correct?
That's right.
Bicknell thrush move around based on the habitat disturbance, correct?
Correct.
So the location and the size of the core habitat could shift over time.
That is right. Yep. Okay.
On page 7 of your testimony, you assert that 8 acres of preferred Bicknell's thrush habitat will be lost, correct?
That is correct.
Does this estimate include the habitat degradation due to edge effects?
No, that is the direct project footprint. And it also takes into account some work that's been done in Vermont regarding the use of edge habitat by Bicknell's thrush. So we don't typically discount the edge effect for Bicknell's thrush based on that work that was done by Rimmer et al.
So the 8 acres includes the edge effects, or is it just the direct?
It's just the direct footprint.
Thank you. Wouldn't you expect the environment immediately around the clearings for the roads and turbine pads to change as a result of the project?
I don't expect the habitat that's not disturbed directly adjacent to the clearing to change significantly.
But the habitat directly adjacent to the clearings will change. There will be light levels will be higher, moisture levels will be lower, invasive
correct.
Species.
Correct. And that is similar to a natural disturbance such as a blowdown, which will also increase light levels, create edges.
So
it's going to have
we were
similar
all
impacts.
At the site visit yesterday.
Correct.
So the area adjacent to the roads, that area is all similar to what a natural disturbance would look like?
If it blew down, yeah, sure. If there's a blowdown, you have stumps remaining, trees down. So areas adjacent to clearing, if they exhibit some sort of direct impact like a blowdown, that's mm-hmm. going to be similar to a natural blowdown.
Okay.
Correct, because there hasn't been any project impact to that area directly. It hasn't been cut, it hasn't been filled, it hasn't been disturbed.
Okay. And so just to summarize, the 8 acres, again, is the direct habitat impact, but you
correct.
Don't have an estimate of the total habitat degradation as a result of the project.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to move on to Dr. Vickery, if I might.